So as we've mentioned, again, for those of you just joining us, so our policy this year is to learn Ravi on Thursdays. One slight exception or condition to the policy is that we do reserve the right that if in a previous year the Aliyah was not learned for whatever reason, to also include that in the Cheshbon. So I noticed that we don't have any records of any Shirim on Parshas Bo for the past 2 years. I assume it must have still been during the break. So technically, Sheni, Shlishi, and Revi would be fair game today. However, Revi is huge. Revi contains all of Maseches Pesachim in it. We probably won't cover all of Maseches Pesachim today, maybe just most of it. So Revi certainly has enough to keep us busy. I'll just mention one point from Sheni because, you know, there are three makos that are covered in this week's parsha. Arba, I think we did speak about when we spoke about Rishon several years ago. Just to say a quick word about Choshech, so which is dealt with in Sheni, and then we'll skip back to Revi. That in terms of Choshech, there's a lot of discussion as to how to relate to the concept of darkness as it is conveyed in the Torah as a makkah, and especially because it seems like it's a physical thing. And from the perspective of physics and of science, it's normally understood that darkness is not a thing, it is an absence of something. It is the lack of light. And if you don't have light, you have darkness, and light comes and dispels darkness. So that seems to be the case from a scientific perspective. In the case of the makkah, so it sounds like the darkness was physical. So some understand that this is emblematic of the fact that it's not regular darkness. It's not simply the absence of light, but there was an actual creation of darkness that this makkah involved. But others understand that that's always the case. So the Vilna Gaon interprets Psukim here in this context and also elsewhere as saying that the darkness of creation, going back to Parshas Bereishis, was a physical thing and is a physical thing. God created night, and therefore night is not simply the absence of day, but it is a actual creation, and that's what it sounds like from the Gemara appropriately in the beginning of Maseches Pesachim. So we'll cover from the beginning to the end of Pesachim today, but in the beginning of Pesachim, the Gemara does seem to suggest that God created the night and gave it instructions, gave it a mission. So in that sense, the Vilna Gaon comments that night itself is a creation, darkness is a creation, even though from a scientific perspective that's harder to relate to. There's a discussion about this in the Sefer Chavetzelis HaSharon, where he notes even then it would still depend, you know, what kind of darkness we're talking about, that if we were to cover up the windows now, it would become dark in this room. But that would clearly be because of a lack of light. So that wouldn't be the mamushus of darkness. But the darkness of night, that's what the Vilna Gaon was saying was the creation. And again, there are those who say specifically in terms of this makkah that it was a different kind of darkness. The Torah Tamimah has a comment on the Pasuk in the second Aliyah about Choshech, where he notes, he quotes from Chazal, that the darkness was the thickness of a dinar. So he says, how could that really make sense? How do you measure darkness? And also the idea being that if it was dark for a while, so then it essentially means that the cycle of the day and night stopped. And the Torah says in Parshas Noach that that won't happen, that Yom V'Laila Lo Yishbosu, that the world is always going to continue going around. So isn't that a contradiction? So he thought, he says, it's a big chiddush, but he thinks that maybe the darkness of Mitzrayim was actually not something external, but it was something that developed on the eyes of the Mitzrim, which also then helps to explain how it could apply only to the Mitzrim and not to the Jews, but that essentially there was some substance that formed over all of their eyes, so they couldn't see. And he says, if you take that perspective, so maybe it's somewhat of more of a rationalist perspective, depending on how you want to relate to this, but he says, if you take that kind of perspective, he thinks that would answer a number of things. That would explain how we could talk about it having some kind of thickness, and how it could be a creation, and also how it wouldn't contradict the world continuing to have cycles of day and night. That still happened, but throughout that time, the Mitzvim had their eyes obscured by the substance that took over, and that's what Makas Choshech entailed. So in any event, just a few words about that, but then to now to move into Revi. So Revi begins by talking about Makas Bechoros. I try to teach my children that they shouldn't insert the word like into sentences so much. That it doesn't come across so well. But here, this pasuk contradicts this. As the Gemara discusses at the beginning of Maseches Brachos, that the first pasuk in the Aliyah says, Vayomer Moshe, Ko Amar Hashem, Kach Atzos Halayla Niyotze Besoch Mitzrayim, right? Which would literally translate as Moshe said in the name of God, like midnight, I'm going to come out in the middle of Mitzrayim. So what's Pshat on light, midnight? Shouldn't he say Chatzos? So the Gemara has a number of interpretations, either that Akash Baruch Hu was speaking at midnight the night before, and he was saying light this time, that's when it'll be, which invokes certain difficulties. Other possibilities that the Gemara alludes to there is that it's actually, despite my advice to my children, worthwhile saying like in your sentences using imprecise language, because if you're too precise, then somebody will accuse you of lying. That, as the Gemara there points out, that you're talking about an approximate time, it's as if to convey that you're not exactly sure when it's going to be. It'll be around Chatzos. So asks the Gemara, Samiyika Sveika Kamek Shabricha, what God doesn't have a precise atomic clock, he can't say exactly when it's going to be. So the concern is not that HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't know exactly when it's going to be, but this has to do with communication. That here he's going to tell Paro it's going to be at this time, and maybe it won't be by his clock exactly that time. On his clock it'll say 12:01, or it'll say 11:59, and I'll say, oh, Moshe, you're a liar. You see, your prophecies are not true. So in order not to provide that type of a trap, so Moshe phrased it like this, it'll be about Chatzos, so don't come back to me when your clock says 12:02. Don't come back to me and say that there is some kind of lie here. So it's an interesting issue to worry about, and there's a discussion about this in the Sefer Sam Derech, Reb Simcha Zissel Broyd of Chevron, and to paraphrase what he's getting at, because this is one of the major issues you see in contemporary discourse, I think this is basically his point, is that it's really a funny concern, right? So here, this is now the 10th Makkah. So Moshe has made all these predictions, and they've all come true, and this will come true too. And you really think it's so likely that when this, the 10th Makkah, is taking place, the detail that they're going to focus on is, wait, yes, it's true, all these 10 things happened, and all the firstborn were killed, but you said it was going to be 12, and it's 12:03, so you don't know what you're talking about. You're a liar. So how likely is it that that's going to really be an issue at this point in time? So I think his point basically is that clearly it's not going to be the issue, but that these types of accusations are not really sincere. They're really a tool that people use to fight with other people. And this is something you very much find in contemporary discourse, that people always pull out the liar card, that anytime there's any kind of disagreement, you call the other person a liar to discredit them. But it's not really the case that what they're saying is necessarily a falsehood or intentional falsehood, or it's necessarily relevant to your argument. It's really kind of a ad hominem attack that, well, it doesn't matter what you're saying because you're a liar because of this and because of that. And it's really a false tool as a way to try to get around the discussion. So essentially that's what they're alluding to here, that the Mitzvah are going to say, well, okay, whatever, this and that, and yes, and we reneged on all our promises to release the Jews, and yes, we've been enslaving the Jewish people, and yes, you clearly have a powerful God, but you're a liar because you said 12 and now it's 12:02. And as ridiculous as that might sound, maybe it's not much more ridiculous than a lot of what we see in contemporary discourse, and that's essentially what's being alluded to here, that you have to worry about even things like that happening, about things like that being invoked. The idea that it says, Ani Yotze B'Soch Mitzrayim, that Kadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm going to really go out in the middle of Mitzrayim. So there is a discussion. One would think that the language really should be Nichnas, I'm going to enter into Mitzrayim. The Rokeach has a comment over here that you see that really Hachnasa and Yitzia, entering and going out, they're really treated the same, they're somewhat interchangeable. This is a discussion we had last year in the first parak of Shabbos, talking about the malacha of Hotzah and whether there's a difference halachically between bringing something into a building and taking something out of the building. But there is a lot of discussion on this pasuk about why is the language here Yotze rather than Nichnas. And the Sefer is Nayim LaTorah, so he suggests that the point is it's not so bechavadik to refer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence as something that kills. Here the firstborn are going to be killed because God is coming in. It doesn't sound so good. It doesn't sound so good to say God came and that resulted in death. What's a little bit more b'chavadik is to say that as God leaves, as he goes from place to place, so it's his absence that will result in the death. So therefore his yotze is not that he's going to come in and kill, he's going to leave and leave death in his wake, leave death in his absence. That's a more b'chavadik way to refer to this particular makkah happening through HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the pasuk continues. The next pasuk says, "Umeis kol b'chor be'aretz Mitzrayim b'chor paro hayoshev al kiso ad b'chor hashivcha asher acher harichayim kol b'chor behema." So this makkah is described as a consequence of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is himself bringing about. So this. This is obviously going to be devastating, and the next pasuk after that says, "V'haisa tzalka gedola b'chol eretz Mitzrayim asher kamohu lo nyasa u'chamohu lo sosif." So there is this major focus on the crying and the screaming that's going to happen afterwards. And the truth is, as Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch discusses, it could be that that's really the point, that the idea is not so much a punishment here, but that Paro has to be made to feel a sympathy for what he has caused, that his loss of his firstborn is going to evoke a cry which should make him realize that he has been mistreating God's firstborn, so to speak, that the Jewish people are treated as the firstborn child of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Paro hasn't yet come to understand how his mistreatment has brought about consequences. So ultimately, this is the last straw. That's what the idea of this makkah is meant to convey. And the Torah tells us here also that it's not only just the human b'chorah, but it's also the animals. V'chol b'chor behema are also going to die. So those Naim Mutara comments that doesn't really seem like so much of an onesh at this point. And once you've already had the makkah of Deber, so we've already decimated the animals, so saying a few more animals are going to die, it's not really going to get noticed here as a consequence. He suggests also that this is a part of the message of the makkah, that it's not only that you haven't had sympathy, but also through your actions you fail to distinguish yourself from the animals. So when we say that the b'chor is going to die, it's the b'chor of the human mitzvah, it's the b'chor of the animals, they're all considered to be together as one unit. And that's a major part of this onesh. The pasuk continues, the famous pasuk that we try to invoke those of us who are not so canine friendly. So the pasuk says, "V'lechol Yisrael lo yecharas kelev l'shono l'me'ish v'yad behema l'man teidun asher yafla Hashem b'im Yisrael b'im Yisrael." And that the dogs didn't bark. They didn't move their tongue, so somehow that's a milah for them, that they didn't, what exactly that means, what exactly is the significance of that. It's not 100% clear, is it, that normally they would have tipped off the mitzvah that something was happening, or that the fact that they didn't bark means that even the slightest physical reality wasn't perceived until this actually happened. It's not 100% clear what the milah is, but somehow the dogs are praised for holding back. And the Chazal tell us that that's why the Torah says that when you have a nevela, so a nevela, to get rid of it, you should give it to the dog. And that's the source, the Gemara tells us, that a nevela is mutter bahana. That we know that sometimes you have a prohibition which is asr b'achila and bahana, and sometimes only prohibited b'achila. So this is also one of the major themes the Gemara has in Maseches Pesachim, to try to figure out, when the Torah says don't eat something, does it generally mean across the board, no eating and no benefiting at all, or just no eating? So from the context of nevela, the Torah says that when you have a nevela, so you have an animal you're not able to eat, so you can't eat it yourself, but you can throw it to your dog. So that shows that it's permissible to get hana. So why specifically does the Torah convey it that way? So the Gemara says it's to show that the dogs were rewarded for holding their tongue at this stage. So we paid them back, and we make sure that they get a little extra flesh. They get a little extra meat. And it's a Kaddish Baruch Hu saying that he doesn't hold back the reward of any animal in a Kodesh Baruch Hu, a kapeas char kol beria, that whatever little bit happens that benefits the world, so a Kodesh Baruch Hu pays you back, and that's recorded. Okay, so now parak continues. Let's skip to the next parak, which is also part of the Saliyah. So, very famous pasuk here at the beginning of Parak Yudalit, the first mitzvah in the Torah, as Rashi famously comments in the first pasuk in the Torah, that the Torah should have started from here. The Torah should have started from this pasuk. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe v'al Aaron beretz Mitzrayim lemor hachodesh hazeh lochem rosh chadashim rishon hu lochem l'chodshe hashana. So here, the first mitzvah, which Rashi was saying should have started off the whole Torah, is the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh, the mitzvah of starting the year with Nisan and of acknowledging months in general. So there's quite a lot of drush said about this. Rav Soloveitchik had a famous comment about this. Really, it's the Sforno says things along these lines as well, that this is really to highlight the distinction between slavery and freedom. That one of the major elements of being a Eved, this is something that Sforno says in his commentary to Dvarim, and he says it also in his commentary here, that an Eved has no control over his time. That's essentially what it means to be a slave, that you're at the bidding of your master. And here the Torah is saying that from now on you're going to be free. From now on, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, you have a month, you have months, you have hours, you have time. Time will be something that you can control. So this is the major bracha and the major challenge of being free. That the idea that you are able to now have some say over how you spend your time, so now it becomes your responsibility to spend your time wisely. Rav Soloveitchik explained that that's why you find that an Eved has an exemption from mitzvah sasei shehazman grama. And we know that women are exempt from mitzvah sasei shehazman grama, and avadim are exempt from mitzvah sasei shehazman grama. It seems to be that they are for two different reasons, that there isn't really much commonality between the two. It's just a din in common, probably not an explanation in common. So in terms of the Eved being exempt from time-bound mitzvos, so that was what the Rav suggested in terms of the sense, that he has no sense of time. There's no reality of time. Time is all a blur because he just gets up in the morning, does whatever the master tells him and goes to sleep. He doesn't have any sense of the past, present, and future. He doesn't have any sense of control. So therefore, it doesn't make sense to give him mitzvos that are time-bound. So that's what's changing here. We say, HaChodesh HaZeh Lochem, and say that now it's going to change. Now you have a concept of time. Now you can control what you're going to do. So that's a very major new reality, and that's where really everything flows from in terms of what the idea of freedom is going to represent. In the Sefer Ohal Moshe, he suggests, he's usually quoting from other Sfarim, I don't know if he's quoting from someone else when he says this, says that that's also why the Haggadah, we recite in the Haggadah, that Yochel Merosh Chodesh, that you could have thought that, as I have a minute to say, that the Haggadah could have been recited already, not just on the 15th of Nisan, on the Seder night, but from Rosh Chodesh Nisan. So what does that reflect? It reflects the idea that the notion of Chayrus is already being conveyed at this point from the beginning of Nisan, that when the Torah is saying that at that point, now you are free, it's a way of saying that this begins your transition from Avdus into Chayrus, the recognition of time as something that you can now control on your own, and therefore it makes sense, perhaps on some level, to recite the Haggadah even then. So those who have the minig to recite the Haggadah on Shabbos HaGadol, it's not Rosh Chodesh, but it's already before Pesach, is a reflection of that idea that there could have been this earlier slot, and perhaps is part of this message. You also find in Chazal that the language of Chodesh should also be read Chiddush, and HaChiddush HaZeh Lachem, that the idea of renewal, that you can recreate yourself, that you can start anew, is contained in this directive as well. And this is the topic of a very long and fascinating drasha of Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch. If you look at his comments here on this pasuk, he has quite a lot to say, and it's all very fascinating. And he says that really, this is the whole idea of Kiddush HaChodesh and of the word Chodesh. And that, what does the title Rosh Chodesh mean? What does it mean in this Pasuk? We talk about Rosh and we talk about Chodesh. So we know we use Chodesh to mean month. But he writes there that Chodesh as month is really a secondary meaning. It's a derivation. That Chodesh really means Chiddush, really means the fact that the month renews, and that itself is a theme of inspiration. And therefore, we focus on that. We talk about Rosh Chodesh really means, how does it actually translate, not the first day of the month. So, because if that's the case, if you look in this pasuk, it's going to be really redundant that we have Chodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chadashim Rishon Hu Lachem L'Chadshi Hashanah. So isn't that then redundant? It's the first twice. So Nisan is the Rishon, it's the first of the month. But Rosh Chadashim and Rosh Chodesh means the beginning of the process of renewal. So the month renews itself, the moon renews itself, and the beginning of that is what we call Rosh Chodesh. And therefore, by extension, we call a month a Chodesh. And therefore, we look to the moon for this kind of inspiration. The Gemara says that the Jews are special because they count their months, they count their years by the moon rather than by the sun. And that's a part of how we identify the Jewish people with their distinct nature. And that's the symbolism that it renews, and therefore this is a symbol of inspiration. So Hirsch, again, has quite a lot to say about this. He says, that's really the idea of Kiddush HaChodesh as a mitzvah. So we have an obligation, historically, to go through a process of sanctifying the new moon, that we look for the signs of renewal in the sky, and we have a whole formal process of Kiddush HaChodesh. So what is that? Is that something that we are dedicating the moon? We're doing something to the moon? Is there something which smells a little pagan about this? So he argues very assertively, no, it's nothing about that. There's nothing that we are doing to the moon through this process. Quite the opposite. It's that we are inspiring ourselves. We're taking this opportunity to reconnect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through the symbolism of renewal that we see in the sky. So it's not that we're using that to really figure out when the month is. He discusses at length that it's really not, that's not what's happening. We're not really figuring out when the date is because we're looking in the sky and trying to calculate how the calendar plays out. The calendar really happens on its own. It's our mitzvah to use this time to reconnect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And he says, that's why you find certain dinim, for example, that this has to be done through a Beis Din, and the Beis Din cannot have any compromises. So let's say you have a Beis Din, you have a Din Torah between two people, so you're supposed to have a panel of three, but if they agree to have one dying, you could have that. So he says here, the Gemara says, you can't have that. You have to have a panel of three dayanim, because this is a process. This is essentially a ritual. It's not that you're actually trying to figure out when the month is, and maybe you could have a big expert who could also figure it out. So he discusses there as well that there were those who said, oh, Nebuch, the Jews, they didn't know how to figure out the calendar. It was only later they were able to find out from the Greeks how to figure out the calendar, and they had to look in the sky. It was all so primitive, and that's what you see here. And he said, no, quite the opposite, that it was clear, first of all, that they did know when it was to be expected and knew when it was going to happen. And they had, the Gemara Rosh Hashanah explains that they had all kinds of chachma in terms of being able to assess this in advance. And the process was a process of mitzvah as a part of this reconnecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that being the case, the situation that we have now, where we don't have regular Kiddush al-Fi HaRi'iyah, and Hillel set up a system where all of the years of the Gullus were decided in advance, so we don't have this scenario, we don't have this ritual of figuring out how to apply the individual Rosh Chodesh, says you might think that sounds like, oh, that's better. We used to have this very inconvenient system where we had to assemble witnesses and we had to go through this complicated process to figure out where the month was. And then Hillel came along and he figured out how to calculate it for all these centuries in advance, so now we're much more advanced than we were then, and that's much better. He says, no, quite the opposite. He says in very strong terms, he says that the real milah is to be able to go through this process and to have this opportunity to reconnect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we're missing that process because of the galus, because we don't have smuchim, we don't have bezdin, we don't have the opportunity to do all that. So because we still have to have a system of when yantif is, so b'diavet, so we have Hillel system, which is a galus system, which is a big step below what we should be doing. And that's something that we feel the lack of. And then he goes on to say, very powerfully, and this is a very major contemporary issue, the much reviled Din D'Rabbanan of Yontif Sheni. So it's always a topic of debate. Everyone says, why do we still have to observe Yontif Sheni? They don't understand it halachically or practically. They say it's such a burden. It is very difficult for people to work, you know, to take off 2 days of work. Your YU schedule, it's not such a burden, but if you're... go out to take a job and falls out during the week. So it's always a big burden, Yontif Sheni, it's true. And it's also not so well understood. You say, okay, so once upon a time, so we had to have this system of figuring out the date based on the testimony, and those who were outside of Eretz Yisrael didn't have immediate information. So, okay, so they had to keep an extra day, misafik. But nowadays, we don't have a suffix anymore, and we have a set calendar, so it all seems like such an anachronism, it all seems so obsolete. Why do we need to have this continued system of Yontif Sheni? That's a very common complaint. So Rav Hirsch says, the whole thing is backwards, the whole thing is upside down. This is the one thing that saves us, is that the lack of Kiddush Al-Pi Hariyah is something that really puts us even further into the whole idea of Galus, something that separates us from one of our most powerful mitzvahs. And the only thing that still connects us to that is the reality of Yontif Sheni Shel Galus. The idea that in Galus we have an extra day of Yontif in order to keep the concept of Kiddush Al-Pi Hariyah in our minds, that's the one thing that keeps us still in the parsha of this mitzvah, and therefore this is a tremendous thing. This is something that we have to hold on to very tight and not disparage and say, oh, the whole thing is unnecessary anyway, and we don't have this fake at the Yoma. And the truth is, when you think about it that way, it's not only a positive way to look at it, but it also helps to explain why the Gemara is quite clear that nowadays we don't have a suffix anymore. It's not that's something that we do misafik. It's a din d'rabbanan that Chazal said, okay, now, even though we're no longer in a situation where we're not sure about when Yontif is, Chazal said, this is the din, we're going to have 2 days Yontif. So the way Rav Hirsch relates to it, it's more easily understood that this is essentially something to keep the galus mentality focused on a very holy mitzvah that would otherwise not have any representation in our lives, and that's something to hold on to quite dearly. Hi. Okay, he also notes there, that's also why, you know, the Gemara says that when it comes to Kiddush HaChodesh, so even if it's a mistake, even if they intentionally change it, so if they stall so that you'll be Mekadosh L'Chodesh the next day, we know that the Gemara says they're allowed to do that, atem afilu shogim, atem afilu mezidin, that even if the Bezdin made a mistake in terms of when the moon was seen, or if they purposely pushed it off a day, it's still going to be chal, so that wouldn't be true in any other din context. So again, he explains that that's not what's going on. It's not that they're trying to evaluate exactly when the day is. It's that this is a mitzvah that takes place around the symbolism of the moon. And he also notes there, again, to refute to those who would say, oh, they didn't know when it was coming. So clearly they knew when to start looking for it. But also the halacha is that if it's not done on the 30th day, so the next day it becomes Rosh Chodesh anyway. So it's already built into the system when it's going to be. And that's clearly not that they're using this to figure out how the calendar should be. They have some control for other reasons when the calendar should be. And Kiddush HaChodesh is essentially a mitzvah. I think we discussed Parsha Shoftim this year, and we talked about the prohibitions of Kishuf and the prohibitions of superstition. And I think we had opportunity to talk about this on Chanukah also. I think it came up a few times, that there is a minig to get married, what's called B'Miluy Halavana, that when the moon is getting bigger, which means the first half of the month, so the moon is getting bigger, it's full moon in the middle of the month, so the first half of the month, the moon is getting bigger, and the second half of the month, the moon is getting smaller. It's called B'choser Halavana. So there is a practice to davka get married during the first half of the month. That's supposed to be a good sign. Let's call it that for now. So there is a discussion in the Svarim, why is that okay? Why shouldn't we say that that's a problem of nechush, that we have a prohibition of superstitious behavior? So for someone to say that he's going to get married during the first half of the month and that's going to be a good sign for a successful marriage, isn't that a problem? Isn't that an issue of nechush? The folks can talk about this, the Tshuva and the Yehudi Allah, and a few others, and they say it all depends how you relate to it. That if you say that, okay, you scheduled your wedding for the second half of the month, and then you found out about this, you say, okay, I'm now going to switch it, and I'm going to pay you a huge penalty, and I'm going to have to find a different caterer in a different hall, and re-invite all the guests, and find a different girl, because she's not interested in that date, and restructure my whole life in order to have it be in the first half of the month. So then, yes, taka, that would be nechush. If you really think that the success of your marriage is all going to rise or fall based on whether it takes place in the first half of the month or the second half of the month, that would indeed be nechush. But when it's not something that's going to have a major consequence in your life, so there is something to admire about the first half of the month because it's a symbol of inspiration. So the idea is we want to have a context which puts us in the right frame of mind. The Gemara in Horia said a similar idea that when a king was anointed, he'd be anointed by a river, and that they would have the statement that the same way this river flows powerfully, so too should the royalty, so too should his reign be powerful. So there also, it's not that we think, oh, he's only going to have a successful reign if he has his anointment by the river. It means, again, it's a symbol of inspiration. We want to have certain ideas in mind as we take on new challenges. That's probably also what goes on Rosh Hashanah night when we have the Siman, and then also it's all part of the discussion. So here too, we find that the moon specifically has this type of effect on us, not mystical effect, not the supernatural effect, but the inspirational effect, that we should look to the simon of renewal that the month represents, and that's a good theme for marriage, and that's a good theme for life in general, and that's what represents the Jewish people, and that's something to take advantage of and to focus on. It could also be, I don't think Rav Hirsch makes this point, but it could be that others do, that the practice that we have of announcing the molad in shul when Shabbos Mevarchim, like we just did last Shabbos. So the idea that we announce the time is perhaps also part of this idea, that we want to call our attention to really the exact moment when this process of renewal starts, because that's, again, the whole point, that we should look to that moment and say, okay, I'm going to take this inspiration and use that as an opportunity to reconnect. So everything that we can do to call our attention to exactly when that's happening, that's a part of this idea. And maybe that's where the practice has developed to announce the molad. And the Svarim, they have many other suggestions as well about the molad. If you look in the Sefer Paris Yosef HaKadosh, on this pasuk, he has a pretty lengthy discussion about different reasons why we do it, but this might be one of them in order to direct our attention towards that focus and make that something that can inspire us. And the Sefer Ohel Moshe, he also writes that the moon has other symbolism too, not just the idea of renewal, but also the idea of being a makabel, that we know that the moon vis-a-vis the sun is considered to be, on the one hand, the Gemara implies that it's a lower level, which, you know, clearly it is in some senses of the word, but the moon has this midah of being able to receive, and that we talk about the Torah, and we talk about tradition, and we talk about transmission, so we have a tremendous focus on the idea of being able to be makabel from someone else, being able to receive. That's what the Jewish religion is founded on as well. So the moon represents that. The sun shines, and the moon receives the glow from the sun. So that's also something that we find inspiring. That's also something that we want to focus on. So perhaps that's also why Chazal tell us that we take pride in being a nation that counts based on the moon. Specifically, the idea of Nisan as the month to focus on. So that's an interesting point to focus. It's not the time that the world was created as far as we understand in terms of Tishrei. So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a comment in a Sefer Darash Moshe that this idea of Nisan as opposed to Tishrei is that it's not enough that the world was created, that's very nice, but we believe the world's created for a purpose, and that's what makes the world justified in the first place. So the Torah is the purpose, And Nisan is a part of the Hachana for the Torah. So the Torah needs Hachana in order for us to be able to receive it. And the world needs the Torah in order to justify its existence. So we focus on Nisan as this symbolic beginning of the count. The point is also that we talk about creation, so it's not just about purpose, but it's also about God's continuing involvement in creation. And you know, this is in distinction, let's say, from a belief that's called deism. So there were people, many of the founding fathers of America had this philosophy, it was known as deism, that you believe in God, that much, yes, you're not an atheist, but the idea that a God continues to be involved in the world, that you don't believe in. Okay, yes, the world must have started somewhere, so okay, God created the world, but he ceases to be involved. So our belief is obviously not that way. And Yetzias Mitzrayim is a major reflection of that. That not only does God put the world here in the first place, but he continues to run events. And that's really one of the major themes of Yetzias Mitzrayim, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu intervenes in history and does so miraculously, does so in ways that are indisputably him, in order to convey the point that it's not simply a machine set in motion and that's just going to go on autopilot, but that there is this active guidance that comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's a whole discussion in general, la halacha. So Friday night, when you make Kiddush, and when you make Kiddush Friday night, so we recite Kiddush with the words Zech Letzias Mitzrayim, and the Gemara says, again in Pesachim, we really have a theme of what's going to cover the whole Masechta here, the Gemara says in the end of Pesachim that that's a requirement, this Gzeir Shava of Zachar and Zachar, Zachar by Shabbos and Zachar by Yetzias Mitzrayim, that Kiddush should involve Yetzias Mitzrayim. So there's a whole discussion just how crucial that is. The Magen Avraham writes that if you go to shul Friday night, even if they don't recite Kiddush in shul, but you have davening, your Friday night davening, so he writes, your Yotzei Kiddush Min HaTorah, that you still have to do Kiddush Makom Suda, you still have to do Kiddush Alakos, but that's all Midrabanan, that Min HaTorah, you'll fulfill the Torah's obligation of Zachar Sama Shabbos Lakadcho. And that has various ramifications. So the Minchas Chinuch objects, the Minchas Chinuch says, what are you talking about? The Gemara says you have to have Zeich Letzias Mitzrayim, and davening, we don't have that. We have that in actual text of Kiddush. But just through davening Friday night, you're not going to have Zeich Letzias Mitzrayim. So he says, you're not Yotze. He objects against the Magen Avraham. So the Mishnah Berurah defends the Magen Avraham and says that, no, it's maybe it's an Asmachta, that maybe really it's a Din Rabbanan, and Min HaTorah, you can have Kiddush without Letzias Mitzrayim. So later, Achronim weren't so convinced about that. And it's interesting that both Rav Asher Weiss Shlita and Rav Yonatan Sack Shlita have in their various forum discussions about this din, and they say the same thing, I think, for opposite reasons. That they basically both agree that really you have to say it's a din daraisa to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim and Kiddush, but it's still nam akeh. It's basically a l'chachila, which is an unusual kind of structure for a din min haTorah. That the din min haTorah is that ideally you'll make Kiddush with Yetzias Mitzrayim, but if you leave it out, you're still Yotze. So the way they come to that conclusion is from two different directions, I think, if I understand correctly. That Rav Asher Weiss is saying that the reason it's not Ma'akev is because it's not really a Shabbos din, it's really a Yetzias Mitzrayim din. That the Gemara was saying that when do you have to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim? So Kiddush is an opportunity to do that. And the Halacha, we actually assume you have to say it twice a day, so it kind of eclipses that din. While Rav Sacks, I think, is really coming at it from a different perspective. Rav Sacks is basically understanding that the idea of Yetzias Mitzrayim is a din in Kiddush, but it's l'chachila din in Kiddush. That l'chachila, you're going to say words of praise and recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that includes Yetzias Mitzrayim also. But if you don't get that far and you just praise him and without that, that would still be at least a b'di'avad fulfillment of Kiddush Min HaTorah. So what's that idea about? So that idea seems to be, like you're saying here, that Kiddush is about God creating the world, Shabbos is about God creating the world, but ideally, when we make that observation that God created the world, we'll be more complete about it. We'll say not only that he created the world, but also that he continues to be involved in the world. So Yetzias Mitzrayim is a reflection of that. So therefore, it's crucial that, or at least ideal, if not crucial, but it's highly recommended that our recognition of God's creation be a more complete sentence, not only that he created the world, but that he continues to be involved. Now, remember that point, maybe we'll come back to it in a few weeks, when it's Parsha Zachar, Zechira Samalik. So I think I've commented in the past that the six Zechiros that we have together could all form one complete hashkafic system, including these two points that I just mentioned. So maybe that point we'll come back to Purim time, Parsha Zachar time. But in any event, it seems to highlight this idea also. So that's another idea why Nisan should be the first month. So we recognize not only Tishrei, God created the world, but Nisan takes it the next step, that he shows that he's going to continue to be involved. And therefore, that's how we should recognize the year. So just to make a few other points about some of the many, many themes that you find in this Aliyah. So then the next pasuk starts talking about the Korban Pesach, the Abruo, Kol Hadas Yisrael Le'emor, Be'asor L'chodesh Hazeh, V'yichu Lehem Ish Seh L'veis Avos, Seh L'Abayis, V'yimat Habayis Miyos Misef, V'lakachu Shecheneo HaKarov L'veis Avos, Mechzas Nefashos, Ish Lefi Yachlo, Tachosu Olaseh. That you should gather together a group that's going to be your chabura for Korban Pesach. You should get your whole family together. Every family should have their own chabura. And if your family is not big enough to cover the whole korban, so you're going to have extra meat. So again, that's the problem, too much flesh. Talk about our scheduling our future events. So then if your family is not big enough, so then you should go to your close neighbors and bring them in also, and do what you have to get the right kind of population so that you can have a chabur that's going to eat the Korban Pesach together. So Rav Eliyashiv, in his Sefer Divrei Agada, Rav Eliyashiv notes here that now we've gone from Kirsha Chodesh to talking about the mitzvahs after that, that begin the process of the Geula. So it says the first step towards the Geula is we have to restore the family structure. That Mitzrayim was a degradation of the family structure, and now part of becoming Klal Yisrael is to reconnect our Achdus. So that begins first with family units, and maybe it's more than that. Maybe the families will involve neighbors as well, but first we begin with the idea of restoring our families. That's the first step towards the Geula. And the Chazal have a drasha, and that's the next pasuk, Ushchenu HaKarov. The Torah emphasizes his close neighbor. So Chazal say, you might think, okay, so it's the next door neighbor. So even better, it's the upstairs neighbor, the one who's really close to you, the one who is as close as possible. And Rav Moshe Feinstein has a comment about this in the Darash Moshe, that this is kind of emphasizing the impact that your chevra has, the idea that the people who are closest to you have a big impact on you, and the more you see them, the more they're going to have an impact. And therefore, Chazal are going out of their way to say that even your next-door neighbor, he is going to have a certain degree of impact, but your upstairs neighbor you'll see even more often, and therefore that's even more of an impact, and therefore you want to share this kadosh experience together. And if they're not going to have a positive impact on you, so then you're going to have to bring in people from farther away who are going to contribute to the strengthening of the Yir HaShemayim that comes from this karma. Okay, to maybe skip a little bit more, because we'll run out of time in a few minutes. But there is a famous vort, just to call your attention to, that I won't be able to go through all of Hilchos Pesach here, but just to talk about some of the points, you know. Hopefully Pesach time we come back to some of these issues. But here, for example, the Pasuk says, Pasuk Yud Gimel, that you're going to have to put blood on your doors in order to have a sign that you should be distinguished from Akris Bukharos. So the Pasuk says, Yud Gimel v'haya hadam v'lachem v'oso habatim asher atem sham v'isi yasadam pasachti aleichem v'lo yevachem negev v'mashchis ba'akosi b'aretz Mitzrayim. That for some reason we need to have blood here so the houses will be passed over. That's where the name of the Yontif comes from. So there is a bit of a drush on this pasuk that the Rashba has a tshuva that there were those who objected. There was a priest who he had a debate with, that the priest said that you think there's going to be a third Beis HaMikdash, you think that there's going to be this ultimate redemption, another Beis HaMikdash. I'll prove to you it's not true from your own scriptures, because the Pasuk says in Haggai, talking about the second Beis HaMikdash, the Pasuk says something like, Godol yeh kvod habayis ha'achron min harishon, that the second Beis HaMikdash on some level will be even greater than the first one. And the pasuk says the achron is going to be better than the rishon. So okay, so you see the second Beis HaMikdash is called achron. So there you have it. That's it. No third Beis HaMikdash. So the Rashba said, no, that's not what the word achron means. That achron doesn't mean last in ultimate sense, in the final sense. It means in relative terms. It means the most recent. Like we have achronim, and Baruch Hashem, we have many more svarim after that. Right? We have, doesn't mean final, it means most recent. And he says, you can see that that's also true from Scripture, because that's a pasuk, is in that Parshas Va'era, that right before Makas Dam, so we have these two other osos that Moshe and Aaron are supposed to show to Paro, and the Torah says that if Paro doesn't listen to the second sign, if he doesn't listen, la'os ha'achron, so then we'll have to listen to this one, we'll have to listen to the Dam. So there it's explicit in the pasuk, says the Rashba, that the second one is called achron, because it's relative to the first one. It's achron. And yet, after that, there's another one. There's makas dam, so you see that achron doesn't mean last. So some of the chassidish svarim, they say that that's what this pasuk can indicate, v'haya hadam lochem lo'os al habatim, that the dam, makas dam, the previous dam, that will be an os on the batim. That will be a sign that there'll be a third Beis HaMikdash, that two batim is not the whole story, just because it's called achron. Achron doesn't mean last. Achron means most recent. How do you know that? You know that from the word, from the dam, makas dam, that came after the other one. Okay. But in any case, and now we go on to have the mitzvos of Pesach. A lot to talk about here, which we won't be able to do in detail, but we have the mitzvah of eating matzah, Shivas Yam Matzos Tochelu, Ach B'Yom HaRishon Teshbisu Sermon Batechem, Ki Kol Ochel Chametz V'Zichros Ha'anef V'Shehim Yisrael, B'Yom HaRishon and Yom HaShvi. Now we have a mitzvah of not having chametz for 7 days, and a mitzvah of eating matzah 7 days with a focus on the first day. So the famous position of the Vilna Gaon, that there is a mitzvah kiyumis to eat matzah every day of Pesach, and a mitzvah chiyuvis to eat matzah the first night. So you have to eat matzah the first night, that's an obligation. Just like we find, it's a gezeirah shava, that this is true also about sukkahs, that sukkahs, the first night, there's a mitzvah to eat a meal in the sukkah, and apparently there is a mitzvah kiyumis, there is a fulfillment of mitzvah all sukkahs long. And so too with matzah, the view of the Vilna Gaon, perhaps some of the Rishonim as well, that if you have matzah throughout Pesach, you're accomplishing something. It's not just that if you're hungry, so matzah is your only choice for a sandwich because you can't have bread, but that there is something to be noted as a mitzvah accomplishment by having matzah throughout. And then the pasuk tells us about the concept of yontif then, the idea of ochel nefesh, the idea that there is a heter to do certain malachos that are in the category of ochel nefesh that are necessary for your yontif enjoyment, as opposed to Shabbos. Shabbos doesn't have that. Shabbos doesn't have that heter. There's a whole discussion of what the nature of the heter of ochel nefesh is. Some understand that basically it's a dichoy, that really these malachas that we do, cooking, carrying, and the like, that we do on yontif, are really prohibited, but the mitzvah of simchas yontif outweighs it, is docha them. While the Ramban suggests differently, the Ramban says that really they're not prohibited on yontif in the first place, that there is different, there are different gradations of malacha. We talk about the prohibition of malacha. So there's malacha on Shabbos, there's malacha on Yontif, there's malacha on Chol Hamoed, and they're not defined the same way. So Chol Hamoed knows a much more complicated discussion, but let's say just in terms of the difference between Yontif and Shabbos, so the Torah identifies malachas Yontif as malachas Avoda. So the Ramban understands that that's to say that Shabbos, all malacha is prohibited. On Yontif, it's only the malacha that's for your work. It's not the malacha that's for your benefit, like ochel nefesh. So therefore, ochel nefesh is simply not included in the definition of malacha of Yontif. And he also suggests, the Ramban, that that's why the pasuk in Bayakel, when it says, lo sevaru eish b'chol mosh v'seichem b'yom ha-Shabbos, you shouldn't do havara on Shabbos. So the Gemara has a couple of opinions why the Torah singles out that one malacha. The Ramban says, because of this point, that on Yontif it's mutter, because it's not included in the definition of malacha for yontif. So for Shabbos, it's not. So the Torah wants to emphasize the point that there are malachos that are ochel nefesh related that are permitted on yontif, but on Shabbos they're aser, and that's why we have that focus on havara there specifically. So the next pasuk has an important drasha on it, that you have the idea of Ushmartem es hamatzos, ki ba'etzem ha'yom hazeh hotzeisi es tzvoseichem, yeretz mitzrayim, Ushmartem es ha'yom hazeh ledoroseichem, chukas olam. That you shall watch the matzos. So what exactly does that mean? So it means a couple of things. It could mean that this is about observing the festival, or it could mean that you're watching the matzos, they shouldn't become chametz, that this is the idea of shmura matzah, whether that's reflective just of the practical concern of chametz, or whether that's reflective of some type of a din of lishma. It's a discussion in the Rishonim, but the Chazal have a drasha on this pasuk that we should read matzos as mitzvos. And we say that mikan she'ein machmisen es ha-mitzvos, that just like we can't let the matzos become chametz, so too we can't let mitzvos become chametz, that we can't allow a delay to insert itself when we do mitzvos. So there's a big discussion, which we won't be able to have today for reasons of time, but it's a fascinating discussion to have, if we could fit it into some other sugya somewhere, about the various principles that we have in halacha that urge us to do mitzvos quickly. So we say that it's the reason, makdim in the mitzvos, we should get to mitzvos at the earliest opportunity. We have a line the Gemara says, Nivamis, for those learning Dafyomi, Shihuye mitzvah sloma shahinan, that you shouldn't delay a mitzvah. We have a principle of Ein ma'aviran al ha-mitzvos, we don't pass up opportunities to do mitzvos. And here, Ein machmitzin as ha-mitzvos. So are these all different principles? Are they all the same principle? Pretty extensive discussion in the halachic literature and the lamdisha literature. What's the difference? What's the commonality between these ideas? So a lot to say about that. Maybe we'll find some other opportunities. But al pi hashkafa, it could also be that this drasha coming specifically here is very significant as far as Pesach is concerned. So Rav Huttner has a drasha about this in the Pachet Yitzchak. I think if I remember correctly, it is the first drasha in the Pachet Yitzchak in Pesach, where he says that the idea of being taught this principle specifically in the context of matzah is very significant. Because, first of all, the whole idea of avoiding chametz on Pesach seems to have a lot more symbolism to it than we appreciate. It seems to be, you know, Chazal, the Gemara Maseches Brachos, compare chametz to the Eitz Hara. The Eitz Hara somehow is symbolized through chametz. Apparently it has this message that you're letting something get in the way of your acting with zrizas, you're acting properly. That's part of what the Eitz Hara represents. And the message of Pesach is to be on top of that. The message of Pesach is to not let that happen, is to assert control. And that essentially, that's very much of a piece with the beginning of this parak Yedalad, that we started talking about a Chodesh Zalachem. So the whole hashkaf of now you have time, so now you have the benefit of having time, but you also have the ability and the responsibility to control time. So this is one of the points that Rav Huttner discusses in this drasha, that the idea is we're trying to show that we are not slaves to time, that we are above time, and that the message of Emach Misla and Mitzvos is to try to beat time, so to speak, not let time overtake you, but to assert your control of time and to make sure that that's something that you show that you are a master of. So that's the symbolism that we find throughout Pesach. That's what Chodesh Zalachem is about. That's what the Isra Chametz is about. And maybe that's why we have also this drasha in Shmartem Es HaMatzos / Mitzvos in order to make that point. And this whole idea of the Eved not having control over his time, just to mention it very quickly before we run out of our time, it's a little ironic to say this at the same time. But despite that, so we have a halacha, which is interesting also. There's a halacha in Poland that there are certain restrictions. Normally you have a worker, an employee, so they should be able to make any arrangement they want between each other. In general, you have monetary rules, so it's also a principle of Maseches Ksubis that called Tanai Shem Mamun Kayim, that two people should be able to make whatever monetary deal they want with each other. But we find that the halacha puts certain limitations on a poel, that a poel is somebody who works by the hour. as opposed to somebody, an woman, who will work by the project. You hire him to do a specific task. So a polo works by a time-based schedule. He gets paid for his time. So the halacha has certain limitations on what arrangements you can make as a polo. So, for example, the Gemara says, polo yachalachse v'chatzi ayom, that a polo can quit in the middle of the day without consequences. And it's a whole discussion, and many poskim assume that you can't contract out of that. That's always a right for a polo. So the Gemara connects that to the idea of ki avadai heim v'lavadim li'avadim, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is declaring that we are his servants, and we're not servants of servants, meaning servants of people. We're not allowed to make ourselves into servants now that we've been freed from Mitzrayim. We know that there is the tremendous criticism of one who would sell himself as an Eved Ivri. So we all think, okay, so we don't really plan on becoming an Eved Ivri. But it's very striking that even a Poel, which gets in the way of your taking off Yontif Sheni, so that has implications that once you're working by the hour, we're already nervous that you're too close to being a slave, you're too close to losing control of your time because you've given your time over to somebody else. So we find these limitations, and there are a couple limitations that come out of this din, that you have to have the right to quit. In some sources, it sounds like you can't contract for too long a period of time, because after a certain period of time, the line between a poel and an eved becomes too murky, becomes too blurred, and that's a whole part of this theme. So we'll just end that. So we have this prohibition of having chametz, also having kol ochel machmetzes, which is not just the chametz itself, but anything that brings about chametz. It could be, I think there might be room to say, that this is also a siag d'oraisa, that we find that we're not supposed to eat chametz. So chametz is an iser kares, so we have certain chumras that come to that. So it extends not just the chametz itself, but to that which is machmetzes. And also, we find that you're not allowed to own chametz on Pesach. We have the prohibition of bayira, bayimatze. And the Ran explains that that's also a function of the fact that chametz is so chomer that it's an iser kares, and also it's something that's mutter the rest of the year. So since it's mutter the rest of the year and it's an iser kares, we're particularly worried about how you're going to prevent yourself from eating it, that we don't prohibit you having pork in your house, because we assume that if you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and you're hungry and there's pork in your house, you're not going to make yourself a pork sandwich because you never have pork. But when it comes to chametz, so 51 weeks a year you can have chametz, and chametz is an iser kares, those two factors together, the Ran says, that's why, that's maybe why the Torah says we're not even allowed to own chametz in order to protect us from violating that. And we discussed, I think we talked about last year, about the concept of mechiras chametz, that was a much longer discussion, which is to say one sentence about it, that maybe perhaps the reason that Klal Yisrael has adopted mechiras chametz despite the controversy is that the Torah is trying to say don't own chametz so that you shouldn't even come to eat it. And we're making a statement by endorsing selling the chametz as a way to keep us away from eating the chametz, that if we don't have any chametz physically, that'll keep us away from it. But also, if there's gezeila involved, if we've sold the chametz to somebody else, so it's not our property, so we're so makbid on lo sigzol, that will keep us away from eating chametz just as much as not having it in the first place. And that's also one of the major themes of our redemption, that the Smag says that we can't be redeemed as a nation until we're known as acting honestly, until there's Kiddush Hashem, until the world knows that the Jews are very careful about Gezel and about all such principles. And otherwise it would be a Chil Hashem if the Jews are perceived as an immoral nation. So God can't redeem us, because the nations of the world will say, how could he redeem such an immoral nation? So therefore we have to show that we're very careful about all these things. So perhaps using Mechiras Chametz as a way to also keep us away from Chametz is a statement to that effect. And maybe in Pesach time we'll have an opportunity to expand on all these ideas, but just in the context of reviewing this week's Parsha, quite a lot to say. Give us a little bit to anticipate a few months down the line, and hopefully give us a little bit to think about and inspire our lives throughout the year as well. So I wish everyone a wonderful Shabbat. See you on Sunday, but before that, we'll just daven mincha.